faith-filled finance. All major UK bank accounts. One app. Provision is built by Christians to help you steward what God's given you. Track your spending, saving and giving in one place. Join the waitlist now at provision.money and get your first month free. That's provision.money.
The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio with me, Sam Hales. The Profile is brought to you in association with the magazine that I edit. It's Premier Christianity Magazine. If you would like a free sample copy of the latest issue, you can head to our website, premierchristianity.com/free sample. Simply type your details in and we'd be delighted to send you a free copy of the UK's leading Christian magazine. But today on The Profile, I'm speaking to Pastor Tim Chaddick. Tim was born and raised in California, where he planted Reality Church in Los Angeles. In 2015, Tim moved to the UK to lead Reality Church London, a community following Jesus and seeking the renewal of London. He's the author of two books, The Truth About Lies and Better, How Jesus Satisfies the Search for Meaning. Tim, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Sam. It's great to be with you.
I'd love to hear more about growing up in sunny California, which I have been to and is incredibly sunny and beautiful. We'll get on to why on earth you would move to rainy London in a moment. But tell me more about growing up in California. Did you grow up in a Christian family?
Yeah, well, you're right, Sam. It is very sunny. And sometimes when I'm on Instagram, we see some old friends and photos of the sun, and my wife and I think, what's that yellow orb in the sky? We haven't seen it so long. So born and raised specifically in the San Francisco Bay Area. My parents were Christians, and my dad was actually a pastor, part of the Calvary Chapel movement. From my earliest years, though, my dad became very, very unwell of illnesses, of which would later lead to his death. And in that particular area, what's interesting is, regardless of the stereotypes of churches in America where there's huge churches on every street corner, that was definitely not my experience, especially not in Northern California. I don't think I ever really met anyone I went to school with who was a Christian, even in name. You wouldn't even meet like a nominal kind of Christian. As I like to say, it's all science and crystals in the Bay Area. So yeah. On the one hand, deeply logical. On the other hand, you know, crystals and granola and kale. And that would be Northern California, basically. So I respected my parents, but as my dad was very unwell, the way I coped with it, my brother and I coped with it, is we just did whatever we wanted to do. And I just kind of rejected Christianity, right. And yeah, Everyone I knew did as well. Yeah. So that was kind of my younger years.
Yeah, I guess when a lot of particular Brits think about America, a lot of Christians will just immediately think of kind of Bible Belt territory and think there's a mega church on every street corner. Yeah. But I've been to California as well, and that's not really quite the vibe there even now, is it?
Definitely not.
It's much more secular, perhaps has more in common than Europe than other parts of America.
I think so. There would be pockets that would be kind of an exception, you know, parts of Southern California, definitely. In fact, my wife is from Southern California, and I remember first moving down there, and I saw Christian bumper stickers on cars, and I thought, what is this? There's like Jesus fish, and I just didn't know anything about it. Yeah, you don't really get the Christian culture, yeah. And politically, it's incredibly, it's San Francisco and Berkeley, so just the whole history there, it's one of the most, you know, in that sense, progressive parts of the state. So yeah, I'd never, the first time I stepped foot in a mega church, I was like, what is this? Like, my idea of church was like, you know, 20 people gathered in a room, light a candle and wait on God and open the Bible.
Yeah. You know? So tell me more about your kind of teenage years. You weren't really kind of following Christianity at that point.
Yeah, that would probably be an understatement. I think I was definitely very bad, but I don't think I was necessarily bad in relation to everyone else I knew. Mm-hmm. One thing that's really interesting, my wife and I chat about this a lot, is a lot of my friends, you know, we did all the typical, you know, sex, drugs, rock and roll kind of thing. But what's interesting is my friends' parents were doing the same things. They were using drugs. In fact, I remember when I was 14 or 15 and I went to buy drugs from a friend's house and the door opens and it was one of my teachers selling it. I thought, what do I do? Wow. Is this like a don't ask, don't tell, you know, situation? So it was just very, very normal. So early on, the way that I think I just coped in life and my dad's suffering and my own kind of, you know, brokenness, from a very early age became very sexually promiscuous, started using a lot of substances. And that all kind of came to a head around the time when I was about 17. I think all of that really caught up to me in a point that was really heavy for me. And I did what a lot of people do, and I tried to clean myself up. And over the next 2 years, basically, I was my own. I wouldn't have used this language, but I was my own self-salvation project. And I thought, I can do this. You know, I'm going to have a great career, and I'm going to stop, you know, doing all these terrible things. And, you know, I didn't need God. Mm-hmm. So I was essentially just a self-sufficient person. So I was lost one way, and then I realized, oh, there's more than one way to be lost, and try to save yourself. So that pretty much summarizes my teenage years.
Sure. And presumably things at home must have been really hard. And did this kind of account for some of the behavior of your dad being so ill?
Yeah, I think so I just grew up with a brother, and the way that my brother and I dealt with it was very different. My brother tended to be a little more angry and depressed. I was more of an escapist. My dad was just bedridden. It was just terrible. He just went through so much pain, so much suffering. My mom worked as a school teacher. And so I think I was a little bit off the radar, so I could kind of, you know, do my own thing, as Californians do. So the way that we dealt with it was very much that. For me, it was probably a way of just burying everything, not wanting to deal with the hospital visits and things like that with my dad. Just kind of, you know what, I'm just going to go into my own world of escapism. Mm-hmm. And that's really all it was when I look back.
So what changed?
There was this, I ran into this this really annoying Christian girl at this event. I was probably about 19. I was in this long relationship with a girl that had just completely fallen apart. She was in San Francisco, and it's just a kind of a terrible situation. So I meet this annoying Christian girl bothering me about going to this Christian event in the city of San Jose, which, if you're where I'm from, you don't go there. Like, you don't go to San Jose. Like, I hate San Jose on principle. And so that was in the back of my mind, and she would keep reminding me of this event. And one morning, after a really rough night of just drinking and partying with a lot of my friends, on 3 hours of sleep, I woke up the next morning and I got a phone call from this girl. She said, "The event's today. You need to come." And at the time, I did not know what was happening, but I had to go. It's like, I've had no sleep. Surprisingly, I was sober, and I said, "I have to go to this." And I got in my car and I drove 2 hours to that, what I thought was a godforsaken place. And I went to this event, and it was a little bit more of what you might expect with a typical, you know, kind of a Christian culture church in San Jose. They have some bigger churches there. And there was this band called Switchfoot, which I hated. I didn't know that they were kind of the holy grail of, you know, Christian music at the time. And this guy just came out on the stage, and he just preached, you know, just the pure and simple gospel. And I was absolutely undone. I was just weeping. All of my sins. It was like I knew in that moment that Christ had paid for all of my sins. And, you know, there's a lot of very dark stuff that I had done and been involved with. I consented to abortions. I mean, just all these things were just had weighed on me for years. And just to know in a moment that I was forgiven, I lost it emotionally. And I remember all the other young people around me were looking over at me. I think it was an altar call, you know, where they kind of bring people to the front. And I was at the front, and the other people at the front were like, "What's wrong with this guy?" You know, I'm like, "I've just been forgiven." And they took me in a back room, and this young kid tried to tell me the 4 steps you need to take. You know, you need to read your Bible. And I was just, "I can't believe I'm forgiven." The poor kid didn't know what to do with me. I was so excited that night that I actually slept in the gymnasium that the church owned, because I didn't want to leave that place.
Wow.
And on my way home to the North Bay area, I stopped by a payphone. Remember those?
Before the days of mobiles.
Before the days.
The dark days.
Yes.
What are we talking here? 80s, 90s?
Yeah, it was the late 90s, you know. But they were definitely dark technological days. So I phoned up all my friends, and most of them were, you know, atheists or, you know, similar. And they thought, "You are crazy." I said, "I've just become a Christian." And like, "You're insane." And basically for the first year of my Christian faith, every single friend I knew thought I was crazy, and I had to defend myself. I started reading C.S. Lewis. I'm like, "I love this guy." And, you know, all the classic apologetics book, Josh McDowell, things like that. And so that was kind of my first year of, this is what it's like to follow Jesus. Nobody else that you know is going to follow Jesus. Yeah. You got to be ready to give an answer for why you believe what you believe. I took nothing for granted. And in many ways, though it was really difficult, I am so thankful for that.
Yeah.
I was invited to a small group at a church, and I didn't care who was in that room. It was all these people that were older than me. We didn't have anything in common, but I was so grateful just to know another Christian. And I will never forget that, especially when you minister to people who, you know, take those things for granted and they say, well, I want more people that are, you know, maybe this age or that age, or I want them to be brunette and have, you know, blue eyes. You know, it's like running eHarmony for the church or something. But man, I think Dietrich Bonhoeffer actually said, you know, even if you know another Christian, you should get down on your knees and thank God from the bottom of your heart and say, by grace alone, I know another Christian. And so I'm really thankful for those, that formative year.
Sure. So I guess your friends probably had very mixed reactions. What was the family reaction to you having this very dramatic moment?
Absolutely incredible. In fact, I don't know if my mom actually believed it. I think my
memory's been praying for years.
Oh yeah, she was. You know, she still is. My mother's just about 75 now, and to this day, she cannot believe that, you know, not only did I get saved, but I'm a minister, and you know. But I think I remember this look of, I think she was ironing something, and I told her, I was like, I gave my life to Jesus. And I remember her just looking at me like, like, do I believe this? This is too good to be true. Like, what's happening? And yeah, it was just amazing. My dad, that was right before he ended up passing away not too long after that, but it was just amazing. And a little bit later, my brother actually came to Christ as well. So right before my dad died, both my brother and I came to Christ, and it was just an incredible redemptive story.
But that was a very special moment.
Oh, it was very, very, it was very powerful.
So at what point in your story did you feel like you were being called to be a pastor?
It was when I started attending a Bible college in Southern California, in part because it was really affordable. And I wasn't quite sure what to do with my life. You know, it was after about a year and a half of, okay, I'm a Christian and I could pursue music, but I've still got time to do that. So I dropped my courses at the time and I thought, you know what? I need to study the Bible. I need to just get my head around this and have a really solid foundation. I got accepted, shockingly, to this Bible college and went to Southern California. I think within my first week or two, I met the girl who would eventually become my wife. So I'm sure people have heard that story many times before.
Absolutely. It's become something of a kind of classic story, isn't it, of meeting your other half at Bible college. In fact, dare I say it, that's where my parents met. I'm very familiar with that story.
Well, I'm a statistic, so I'm happy about that. And I remember having a conversation with her about ministry, and I told her I never want to be a pastor. I just don't want to do it. I had a glimpse as to what, you know, what went on with that. And I just didn't, you know, I was happy to serve in church, but I definitely didn't have any kind of ambition or desire to be a part of that. And it was actually when there was a few influential teachers and pastors during that time, but one of them in particular started having me read Martin Lloyd-Jones books in my studies. And one day in the bookshop, I saw Preaching and Preachers, his famous book on obviously preaching, great title. I bought it, started reading it, and I got to the chapter where he preaches on, or teaches rather, on Romans 10, how shall they hear without a preacher? And I remember vividly reading that text, Romans 10, how shall they hear without a preacher? And it was like the Spirit of God was just calling, this is what you're going to do. I just felt compelled. From that point on, I thought, okay, something's happening.
Yeah.
But what does that mean? What does that look like?
Yeah.
So I started, you know, I signed up for these like homiletics courses, preaching courses, little opportunities would arise here and there, you know, to teach or preach, and people would kind of identify that gift. Oh, you can communicate when you're not being totally ADD, you know, oh, that's good. You know, just little things like that. And then by the end of my time at Bible college, it became clear that I think I need to pursue this.
How quickly after Bible college did Reality Church LA come about?
So I finished in 2001, and we didn't start the planting in LA until 2005. So in between that time, worked at a church for 4 years. That's where I got my ordination, got a lot of training, you know, funerals, weddings, you know, teaching, all of that, which was an incredible experience. But during those years, I met a guy named Britt Merrick, who was essentially the founder of what is now called the Reality Family of Churches, which is not huge. It's just a small movement, but very thankful for it. He started it, and I think what I loved about what they were doing in California at the time was a strong emphasis on good theology, faithful Bible preaching, openness to the ministry of the Holy Spirit in a very healthy way. We became great friends. And he said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, my wife and I have been praying about church planning. I love urban areas. San Francisco was always on my mind. So we were praying, and he said, well, where do you want to plant a church if you were to plant a church? And I said, San Francisco. And he looked back at me and he said, what about Los Angeles? And I said, I hate LA. Like, LA's terrible, because if you're from San Francisco, you have
the rivalry. And
you have to. Yeah. You have to look down
on
it.
I'm sure
it
works both ways as well.
Oh, yeah. SF's like, we created Twitter, but we don't use it. You can use it, LA. It's like the annoying little brother that wants to hang out, you know, and you're like, go away. So that's very much the relationship. But my friend Britt said, well, why don't you just pray about it? Because where we want to plant is in Hollywood in particular. So just pray about it. So my wife and I spent 8 months, and there was no kind of one moment where the Spirit of God broke in and said, you must plant. You know, we saw the Hollywood sign in the sky or anything like that. But over the course of those 8 months, we felt a settled conviction that we have to do this. We're called to it. So my wife and I would travel up to LA and just spend time there, kind of walk the streets, pray. And so at the end of 2005, we got everything ready and planted. We only had a team of like two people. There's a handful of people that we had met. Yeah. Sadly, all the great church planning books that are now available en masse, I don't remember seeing any of them.
Right. Yeah.
Somebody handed me a Tim Keller sermon on a CD, like an MP3 CD in 2005, and they're like, listen to this. And I was like, who is this Presbyterian guy? And, you know, little did I know he'd grow on and write like the manuals on church planning. But
yeah.
All that stuff was very influential, and so yeah, we started with a handful of people in a living room, and had our first service at the beginning
in 2005.
Yeah,
so there you go. And from 2005 to 2015, you were heading up that church, Reality Church LA, and then of course after that, which we'll get to, you moved here to London, which where you're now based. But let's hear a bit more about this church. I mean, first of all, Reality Church. Where does that name come from? What does Reality Church mean?
Yeah, it is a funny name. I get asked about it all the time. I suppose it essentially means two things. One, there's kind of a biblical idea primarily focused on Paul's word in his letter to the church, Colossian church, where he says Jesus is reality. He's saying, you know, when the Bible's talking about like what is most important, God is the reality. When he pulls back the curtain on everything, it's a person. And so we're saying that ultimate reality is the God of the Bible, and we want everyone to meet with him. So plain and simple, that's kind of the idea behind it. There's also a more practical, philosophical way in which that, which the name functions for us. And that's just how we want to operate. We want to be authentic. We want to not wear the mask. We don't want to play church games. If we've got issues, difficulties, let's deal with it. When it comes to difficult passages in the Bible, let's not shy away from it. Let's talk about it. Let's deal with it. So it kind of really shapes the philosophy of our church.
Hollywood is such a fascinating place to plant a church.
In many ways.
And LA as well. I mean, LA is like the entertainment capital, certainly of the West, arguably of the world. You have a very certain kind of person who would work or live or visit somewhere like LA. There's a lot of kind of cool, hip churches. You've got the kind of Hillsongs, you've got Mosaic. Do these sort of things sum up the approach to something like Reality Church LA as well?
In some ways, I think it's a little bit different. And I'm definitely a huge advocate and fan of a variety of church expressions, you know, kind of high church, low church, fog machines, lasers, or not, wooden pulpits, like I don't, you know, whatever kind of suits you. That's great. I think for us, it was actually more a simple approach. So with the exception of Mosaic, a lot of the churches that are now known for being in Hollywood, they didn't start until the last 5 or 6 years. So when we moved in, we'd heard of Mosaic, but a lot of Central Hollywood were dying mainline denominations in the States. And the churches that tended to be strong were very focused on a particular background. You'd had Korean-American churches, Spanish-speaking churches, and whatnot. And so in the midst of that, I think what our philosophy was let's actually keep it really simple. And one reason I was actually intimidated, or maybe just not really interested in trying to have a huge production value, is because everyone we were ministering to did that as a profession.
Right.
And it almost seemed like a joke to me, to it, at least if this were our approach, to say, hey,
we can,
like,
do this.
We can do this. Then everyone, in fact, one of the guys on our lead team in the early years, he's one of the greatest set designers in Hollywood. And he loved the simple approach. We just kind of dimmed the lights, and, you know, I preached for like an hour, you know, stuff, all the stuff you're not supposed to do. Yeah. The music wasn't that impressive, you know, and we just didn't really put a lot into it. And for some reason that just worked really well for us. We just kind of kept it simple.
So tell me about how it worked, because you started with how many people?
It was probably about, you know, 15
okay.
people or so.
And then you fast forward 10 years later to when you leave, and how many people were going?
It's about 2,500 to 3,000.
It's a huge growth.
Yeah, it was crazy. And it was not typical.
Yeah, and not what people expect, because, again, you know, maybe this is a bit of a cynical view, but there are those who would say, well, what happens is you have a church turn up and they do the production stuff properly and they have the light show and the guitars and everything else, and that does help attract people. I mean, it just does, right? Especially younger people in a city like LA. You're saying that wasn't the approach. So how do you explain the growth?
Yeah, there's one story in particular that stands out. There was a little bit of slow growth. I think the first year or two, you know, we went from like 30 to 50 to 75, and most of it was relational. Friends would invite friends. But one thing that happened in particular that was an incredible story is a young student who had graduated, or he was near graduating, one of the well-known universities there, USC. And he was one of those guys who loved Jesus. He had a great reputation amongst all his Christian friends and his friends who were not Christians. And he got in this terrible accident. He went into a coma for months, and he eventually died. But during that time of his coma, I remember, you know, visiting family in the hospital and, you know, people praying for him. But all of his friends who weren't Christians, or Christians who had kind of fallen away, it was this as if all of a sudden they started becoming concerned about their own souls. They were concerned about their friend, and they said, well, what church does he go to? And they just started showing up. They started coming to church. I would preach these terrible, or at best mediocre, sermons. and I'm, that's not a false humility. Like, my father-in-law attended our church. He's like, yeah, your sermons were pretty bad. So, and yet,
encouraging.
Yeah, it was great, you know, great wisdom. And yet people would just respond. There'd be these, you know, tears, and people would be giving their life to Christ. Wow. And I remember honestly thinking, this is, God is doing something.
Yeah.
And it just grew, like 150, 200 people, 300 people. It was just this thing that happened. And it was definitely not manufactured, and it was incredible. And it just didn't stop. But I think most of the growth was really through a relational, you know, someone would just really just catch on fire for Christ, and they would just invite their friends, family members. LA, one advantage is LA is a very social place. So if you're an individual that gets excited about something,
You
tell people.
I guess that's the way it should work, and the way it's worked since the beginning, arguably, with Christianity. It's simply,
I think so.
Simply us sharing with those around us. And I mean, it's no more complicated than that, arguably, is it?
Yes, I would agree.
When it did start to really take off, though, I'm sure there must have been a lot of logistical challenges. Oh. Suddenly going from a handful of people to hundreds, and you've got to manage things like buildings, and where do we meet, and do we need to put structure around this? And presumably all that was completely new for you, you know, still fairly fresh out of Bible college. So how did you manage that? Was this a case of putting good people around you who could advise, or figuring it out for yourself? How did it work?
Yeah, that's I think it really, at any size, I think you always have to deal with those complexities. And I, as you say, I think the most strategic thing for me is, it's almost like using the example in Acts chapter 6, you know, Peter preaches this amazing sermon and thousands get saved, and then all of a sudden there's drama and difficulty, and you've got to appoint spirit-filled people to do the work. It very much was that. Mm-hmm. Part of the freedom that I had just as a leader is knowing that I don't have all the answers, and I'm totally fine with that. And I'm really happy to help and empower people and make sure that they have the support and encouragement that they need. So in some ways, we were kind of groping in the dark, as it were, trying to learn from what other people had done. But it really boils down to a few key people who were really gifted in that way and would see the kind of pain points. I think what I saw was my responsibility was to make sure, and this is something I'm very passionate about, is make sure that structures serve relationships, not the other way around. it's very easy to become corporate and, you know, we need some kind of structure.
Yeah.
So I'm not denying that.
I think it's really hard to manage, though. I mean, a lot of people go through this where, like you say, when things get bigger, it necessitates some sort of structure around it. But if you're not careful, before you know it, you've got this really kind of authentic thing that's just happening by itself, and you put too much structure around it, and suddenly it becomes incredibly controlled. Like, how do you build structure in a way that still enables people to follow the spirit and go where they need to go?
I think one principle that we definitely learned is always be flexible. I think when somebody has a great idea for structures, this is how we're going to do our small groups. This is how we're going to do our volunteer rota on a Sunday or whatever it might be. Once the plan is implemented, people tend to want it to be concrete, and then they don't adapt to the needs of the people.
It becomes a kind of rule that you can't break.
Exactly. One really helpful thing in that, and this is where I do think that making sure the values are implemented into every part of the ministry, is sometimes with logistical, you know, kind of structure things, you just give it to the structure people and they run with it. But I want to make sure that those people know that it's all about loving and serving, you know, turning over the spreadsheet, putting a face on it, and remembering that, you know, it's great that we've got this spreadsheet or we're using this app or that app, but show up and get people to pray together, ask them how their day is going, like, you know, implement those things into your strategy.
Yeah.
You know, take time to pray. Yeah. Don't just assume they're not going to pray. Before you set everything up at church, stop. Let's take 10 minutes. Let's pray together, and then let's go serve. Those things just make all the difference.
You're listening to Premier Christian Radio with me, Sam Hales. It's The Profile, and I'm sitting down with Tim Chaddick, the lead pastor of Reality Church London, to find out more about his life and testimony. We'll be right back with the second part of today's show after this.
Billy Graham was the man who preached to millions. Don't miss this month's Premier Christianity Tribute Magazine to our generation's greatest evangelist, with photos, interviews, and features on his life and legacy. Plus, our exclusive interview with Franklin Graham, son of Billy. Krish Kandaya reveals why the cross is bigger than you think, and we investigate the Easter miracle of holy fire in Jerusalem. All that plus much more. Ask for your free copy of our Billy Graham Tribute Magazine at premierchristianity.com/freesample.
The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Well, a very good afternoon to you, and welcome back to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio with me, Sam Hales. Today I'm speaking to the pastor of Reality Church London, Tim Chaddick. Let's listen in to the second half of my interview. If we've been conducting this interview, say year three or year four of you starting Reality Church LA, and I asked you, how long are you in LA for? What would you have said?
Oh, dear. What did I say? I can't even remember. It was all a blur. I think we knew that we wouldn't be there forever, but we definitely didn't have a timeline on it. Everything was kind of happening. And so there were never days where I'm thinking, oh, what's next? Or where am I going to move? Like, that definitely wasn't on our radar.
So when did London come up?
London has been definitely a part of our story for a long time. In fact, when I first went into ministry years and years ago, a guy named Brian Broderson, who was a pastor from the States, actually lived in London for several years in the 1990s, started Calvary Chapel Westminster. I met him through Bible college, and he took me on a trip to London in the year 2000. It was January 1st, the year 2000.
Oh, wow.
So, big day.
How did you celebrate the millennium? Were you on a plane at the time?
We were on a plane,
Wow. What was that like? Did the whole plane sort of cheer, or was it all just everyone sleeping?
You know, I think everyone was sleeping.
Oh,
I think
that's disappointing. I mean, I remember the turn of millennium. That was huge. Everyone was fearing. Weren't people fearing that planes were going to drop out of the sky, actually?
Yeah, Y2K.
Millennium bug and all that stuff.
Yeah. Oh, wow. It's been so long since I've even thought about it.
So you dared to get on a plane.
We dared to do the impossible. and we ended up staying at a bed and breakfast in Twickenham, you know, to celebrate.
Living the high life.
Yeah, the wilds of Twickenham. So yeah, that was my first trip, and we traveled to different parts of the UK visiting churches, and we got involved in Creation Fest, which is a Christian music festival down in Cornwall that is still very...
Still going strong.
Still going strong to this day. So we were involved in it in the early days, and at that time, I was playing in some some Christian bands.
Oh, go on. Which one? Do tell.
Nobody really knows.
Oh, go on.
It was a band called Smithfield. Right. We were basically the filler band, for... I can't remember
who
Delirious
playing?
Played, but
Delirious.
Whoever it was, we were like the, hey, do we have a slot, in the 3 p.m., slot? Let's put them in there. But it was great fun, and we would go out and we'd play in schools, which was great. The fact that you could go into schools and they would let us, share our testimonies and stuff was amazing. And I know there are some people that still do that strong. So anyway, we were involved in that, and we had there's a great couple that we sent out around the time that we started Reality LA. They're from LA to come here as ministers to try to plant a church. They were here for 5 years. So we had relationship with them. I would come back to visit them as well as get involved with different wider networks. And so long story short, all of that was just on our radar.
Yeah.
And we thought one day we may end up in the UK, but it wasn't until the last probably 2 years that I was at Reality LA that everything was going well. Just in our heart, there was a sense that our time is coming to an end. And it was the strangest feeling because it wasn't like the ship was sinking. And we thought, oh, this is a good time to ask God for what the next step is.
Yeah.
Everything was, seemed healthy, and it was great, but we couldn't shake that sense that our time was coming to an end.
And was there an obvious kind of transition plan, obvious personal people to hand over to?
There were definitely options. In-house options, which was great. One person in particular who was a guy that we had hired several years prior to this moment we made our decision, just a real faithful man, incredible teacher. We just got on so well. And so as my wife and I were really praying through, are we actually going to leave? And are we going to move to London? This is crazy. But in the back of my mind, this particular person was definitely my first choice. Mm. So as we were praying, we knew there would come a time where we would have to tell them, shocking news, we, through a lot of prayer, we're, sensing that God's calling us to the UK. And I actually remember the day that I told my friend this, who was on our staff team, he was fully supportive immediately. He also said, well, now we need to pray if we're called to this.
Yeah.
We need to pray if we're called to Reality Light in this capacity.
Yeah.
And so it really began... in one of my favorite verses in the book of Acts is, it seemed good to the Holy Spirit and to us. I love that phrase. And that was very much the process of discerning my call. I knew this wasn't just about what God was calling me to do. I knew I cared deeply for my church in LA, deeply for the staff team. And I want to make sure that this is done healthy. And there's a lot of ways in which we've all seen transitions go very badly. So we were very committed to praying a lot. One by one, told every leader, from like the highest up part of the leadership team all the way down to just team members on different part of the staff team about what God was calling us to. And we pray together. And we did that for about 6 months before we ever announced it to the church.
You hear quite a lot of stories actually of Brits going over to America.
Yep.
And, seeing some real, I hesitate to use the word, but success, what I mean? Bigger numbers. And it's been argued that easier really to plant a church there than it is here. Mm-hmm. And I think certainly people would also argue it can be very hard going the other way. And you've gone the other way. You've kind of, in some people's view at least, done the difficult path of going from America and certainly leaving behind a big structure, a big church. And
the sun.
Yeah, and the sun, very important.
just want to...
But what I was amazed about was you were telling me just a moment ago off air that that when you came over, it was just you. It wasn't like you turned up with a huge team of 100 people. I mean, I know people who have discussions, particularly about church planting in London, and they'll say, well, you need to start with 100 people to really make an impact. That wasn't your story. So tell me about what happened when you came over.
Yeah, I know for my wife and I, we're very relational people. And I think one thing that I just shy away from, I don't know if this is, I probably have some more philosophical beliefs about it, but personally, the idea of parachuting in and just kind of landing, like, there's this ship coming and we're going to land and, we have brought church to you. I just don't, that approach doesn't work for me.
Mm-hmm.
I want to build relationships and out of that relational core, see what God does. So that was really our plan. Again, there's definitely other ways to do it that are fruitful and God blesses them. But for us, we just had to be faithful with how God's wired us and how he's called us.
So this looked like just you and your family getting on a plane, coming over and starting to make friends.
Yes. We, thankfully over the years, we definitely had some you know, some good friends personally. Vicar and his wife in particular, their whole family, we'd been friends for years. They just loved us and received us immediately as family. I got to work with this vicar for the first year of while we were living here in London on an evangelism project with his church, and it was amazing, and we felt very welcome. But it was during that year that we took the time to develop some relationships, mm-hmm. some connections that we had, and we started doing prayer meetings with those people, and then out of the prayer meetings, we started doing vision meetings to fill people in more. Here's what we believe. Here's mm-hmm. what our vision is. And then once we felt that those vision meetings were, you know, going well and people were really kind of, you know, together on that vision, that's when we began to prepare for our first Sunday.
Did you encounter any kind of almost like negative stereotypes from some Christians and feel like, oh, you know, even just little things like your accent might put you at a slight disadvantage here of people having this opinion of, oh, who is this kind of mega church leader coming over here? Was that a tension at any point?
Yeah, there was a little bit of that. I was actually surprised that there wasn't more, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I think I was personally prepared for getting a lot of church planning in general. I noticed it even in LA when somebody would come, didn't matter if you were coming from the UK or Ohio, when you just come into a city and you're the new person, doesn't matter what denomination you're from, there's this kind of insider outsider thing.
Yeah.
And having pastored in LA for 10 years and watching new church plants come in,
yeah.
it was something that I remember God doing in my own heart saying, mm-hmm. you know what? Don't have that attitude. Mm-hmm. Bless people, welcome them. Whatever you have to teach, teach, and whatever you have to learn, learn. So for me, coming here, it was like with fear and trembling. I did find myself having a few times, because if anybody knew about our former church,
yeah.
they would say, well, Tim, you know it's not like that here. You're not going to get thousands. I'm like, I know. I mean, I don't know. I guess I know. Maybe I don't know. Maybe I do need you to tell me. I don't know. We had pretty low,
yeah.
not low expectations, but...
you understood the cultural difference, perhaps, to yeah. a certain extent, having been here before, that it wasn't going to be the same church or...
Yep. We just basically all our ideas and visions, we wrote them out in pencil and gave them to God. And God, whatever you want to yeah. to do, we just want to be faithful.
Sure. Yeah. So tell me more about what that looks like.
We've only been here for 2 years and almost 3 months.
Oh, wow.
And the church is a year and 4 months old.
Wow.
If we were to take the kind of first Sunday.
So this is still March. Really new.
Very new. Very
so new. What does it look like? And I'm expecting the answer is quite different to what you left behind in LA.
Yeah. I mean, it's different in all the right ways.
Yeah. Same values, I guess, same sort of vision, but outworked in a different way.
Yeah, I think I definitely haven't changed, you know, my theology hasn't changed in the general vision of discipleship and evangelism and, you know, just faithfulness to biblical preaching. None of that's changed. It's just with totally different people mm-hmm. and seeing the ways in which their gifts and personalities, you know, really, you know, take the mission forward. That's what I really get excited about. And I think personally, I've been freed from trying to have this one idea of how that looks.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just thankful that people that we've gotten to know over the last, you know, year and a half, 2 years since we've been here, I just feel so blessed and fortunate. Like, these people are amazing. When my wife and I moved here, we think we know nobody. And now my own children, my oldest of which is a teenager, and she sees these people who are now in our church, the church we didn't even know what it would look like. And now these men and women like love our children and love, you know, my wife and I, and that's incredible. Mm. Like, this is our family. This is our community. And along the way, we've been able to see new people come and people come to faith and see the church kind of take its form and shape because of that. So I have my kind of non-negotiables of, mm-hmm. you know, doctrine and preaching the gospel and all of this, but the flavor of it, you know, I'm happy for it to, you know, change over time, as long as it's being changed by what's happening in the community. I love that.
So how does it work practically? You're meeting, hiring a building, how many services?
Yep. We started probably 9 months. We started meeting in the Sunday afternoons in a community center. And the opportunity opened up for us to meet in the old theater of London School of Economics near Temple Station, which was amazing. And it was right about the time when, if I know for my wife and I having kids, the afternoon time slot can be pretty brutal. Lots of other people love it, but it was just really hard for yeah. us. And I think we were at the size where the community center, we were just kind of at capacity, and it was getting a little more difficult to make it happen there.
How many people were turning up at this point?
There's probably about 100, and 20 people.
Yeah, in the community center. Yeah.
Yeah. The theater at LSE is just so great, and they gave us storage there, and it's just been an amazing partnership. So we've been there since September, and we moved to a morning slot, and it's just been so great.
So, I mean, slightly more philosophical question, but why church plant? Because there are those who would be very familiar and say, well, this is the way it's done. But actually, as a concept to start another church, there'll be those who argue, especially somewhere like London, that there are hundreds of church buildings, a number of them don't have many people in. You know, why don't we kind of go in and renew the building that's already there? Why start a whole new congregation? So what's the kind of philosophy of church planting?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think I'd probably answer that in a few ways. I think first, I have a theological conviction about church planting. My general, I guess you could call it a rule for life, is I don't want to be need-driven, but call-driven. So I think at the end of the day, needs can make us aware of a call. But when I look at the life of Jesus, he's not just meeting every need. He's doing what the Father wants him to do. And I think we take into consideration all the facts and all of that, absolutely. But ultimately, if I'm going to be faithful in something, and if I'm going to stick to something when it's hard, I've got to know not just that it's a need, but God is calling me to this. So that would be my theological conviction. But I suppose I do have a philosophical conviction, which is very important to me. I just think the more church plants, the better. I think, A, the statistics show us that there are so many people who have not yet heard the gospel of Jesus Christ. The amount is just staggering. And I just think church planting is one of the most effective forms of evangelism. So I would love for there to just be thousands and thousands of churches.
When you say it's an effective form of evangelism, are we saying, though, just putting on like another service in a new place under a new church plant, that in itself is evangelism? You know, do people still just sort of turn up to a Sunday morning service if they're interested in Christianity?
Great question. I think it's multifaceted. Yes, there's something about any gathering where a new person walks in. I just think that's how a lot of people learn. There's a lot of, I love to go to lectures that are put on in central London. That's just how I hear about new ideas instead of watching a TED talk on YouTube. Like if there's an opportunity for me to go and to hear ideas presented, I love that. Mm. And a lot of people I meet do.
Right.
So in one sense, I had a friend from a co-working space come, he's not a Christian, and loved the idea. Like, I'm going to come. And he came and loved it. And he continues to come every so often because that's a way for him to engage with ideas. So there's definitely something to be said for that. So that is another evangelistic opportunity. But I also think that church plants, there's a high level of ownership that is required amongst all members that you cannot afford to just sit back. If you go to a more established church, I'm not saying this should happen, but some people walk in and they think, oh, it's all up and running. I can just kind of receive. But there's something about a church plant that I've seen, even in the last year and a half, I've seen so many people grow precisely because they said, I'm going to help with this. And as a result of me having that high level of ownership, evangelism has been increased in my life because I'm in this, I'm aware, I'm inviting my friends, I'm talking about it in a way that I wouldn't have talked about it before. I also think that Tim Keller actually does talk about this a lot, that you can have two churches side by side who have the same doctrine, but their particular ministry emphasis or focus, you know, could be very, very different. They have two different philosophies of ministry that could be reaching very different kinds of people. And I think that's great. I love that. I was not threatened by that in LA, and I'm not threatened by it now. I just think it's amazing.
How many reality churches are there now?
So most of them are in California. The three wild cards are us, of course, here in London.
Yeah.
We have a church in Boston, Massachusetts.
And the other coast of America.
Yes, the other coast, which, by the way, is actually equal flying time to go from LA to Boston as it is from London to Boston.
Wow.
So I'm suggesting to everyone we should meet in the middle, although California weather is great. And the third wild card is Honolulu, Hawaii.
Wow.
So you could not get more opposite.
Now, so, this might be unfair, but I have heard people joke about, oh God, why did you not give me a call to Hawaii?
Yes. In fact, the family that we sent to go plant in Honolulu, he knew that part of accepting this call was to put up with that joke.
That joke.
You're suffering for Jesus in Hawaii.
Suffering for Jesus.
But it actually, believe it or not, it has a lot of challenges.
I can believe that.
There is,
I mean, I've already mentioned, perhaps unfairly, a couple of times the difference between America and the UK, but we should state as well, there's no such thing as an easy place to plant a church.
Yes.
At the end of the day.
Ministry is hard, no matter what. So yeah, we have Reality San Francisco, Reality LA, Ventura, Carpinteria, Santa Barbara, Stockton, Boston.
So this is a church planting movement then?
Yes. Movement always sounds so much bigger than it actually is, like nine churches. Is that a movement? So we actually prefer to call it a family because it's part of what we're trying to promote. And usually I don't like slogans, but our little slogan, if we have one, is we don't want to plant many churches, but healthy churches. And so we want to go slow and steady. We want a lot of prayer and investment from the whole church family. So whenever we plant a church, everyone's all in. All the churches donate, all the churches pray, all the churches support relationally. Mm-hmm. And that's just worked for us really well.
There's so many statistics coming out almost every week about Christianity in general in this country being in decline. Is that your experience of planting a church, that actually is really, really tough and the culture and secularism is just growing all the time?
I think there's different ways to answer that. I love to read all the latest articles, and it's interesting because you definitely get different perspectives. I think, was it the New York Times? I can't remember. There was one article I remember back in the States where it said, you know, Christianity is on the rise more than it's ever been. And then another article would come out and say, well, no, that was based on certain statistics. So the only way I think I could really answer that is currently, I think definitely the trend, at least how people think, is definitely, you know, has changed and is continuing to change, depending on how you define the term secular. People really do think like that. Even people in the church have tended, you know, to kind of take on a more secular way, at least of viewing the world, whether they realize it or not. We've been shaped by how we use our phone and how businesses run, how we view ourselves. And that tends to trump, you know, at times, sadly, even our own faith. So I definitely think whether you're talking about someone who's not a Christian at all and has no Christian background, or to somebody who's been raised Christian, but really their formation has taken place in a more secular way, I think the church is always, you know, fighting that trend, as it were. And so in a sense, I think you almost have to preach the same message to both. You have to preach to the person who doesn't, you know that much about Christianity, has a lot of questions. And in some ways I find myself, you're almost preaching that to even the person who perhaps grew up in a Christian home, even my experience here.
What's been the best day and the worst day of your ministry so far?
Oh, and just life? Goodness. You know, I think I can definitely tell you my worst day, I think, was the man who founded the Reality Family of Churches happens to also be, other than my wife and close family members, probably the dearest man on planet Earth to me. He's my best friend. He's been so, you know, since we started our friendship way back when. And his daughter, who was born on the same day, around the same day as my oldest daughter, she ended up getting cancer, this kind of mysterious Wilms tumor. And it was three brutal years. This was back when she was 8 years old, of just, you know, thousands of people were praying and, you know, the surgery would be done, the chemo would happen. It looked like it went away. It came back, looked like it went away. It's 3 years. And eventually she went to be with Jesus. And I believe she was about 8 or 9 at the time. And I remember the weekend that it happened. I was scheduled to preach at my church, and my whole church knew. It was such a public way to, you know, when someone in that position suffers, everybody knows about it. And he was my best friend. It wasn't like, here's an announcement about this church leader and let's pray for them. I wept every single service. But I also didn't, you know, I wasn't trying to make it about me and my own processing of it, but I also couldn't apologize or pretend that I wasn't absolutely heartbroken. That was definitely, I think, the toughest day that I've ever had, you know, get up there, preach the word to our church, but mourn and weep and just, you know, a child going through that. It's just horrible. It's just absolutely horrible. Best day? That is such a hard one to choose. I suppose I have to, I think, you know, in the States, because of the way that the school break happens during Easter, you don't get as much time off. And so Easter Sunday in many ways is almost like a carol service, at least my experience here in London. It's kind of the big opportunity. Everyone's there around. They're not away on holiday. And so it's an easy ask, invite somebody to church. And we had the opportunity to rent out these big theaters in LA and just make a huge deal out of Easter. And we would do baptisms right there on the spot.
It's a great day to do it, isn't it?
Oh,
Easter Sunday.
Just
baptism.
Amazing baptisms. And yeah, there was one we got to do at this one theater on Sunset Boulevard. We actually did the baptisms on Sunset Boulevard. It was like amazing. Wow. You know, people were driving by and, you know, the marquee said, "Jesus loves LA" at the Hollywood Palladium. It was amazing. But my favorite moment was we did one of those services and my oldest daughter got baptized. And it was just a beautiful. Yeah, just thinking we're like this church that has no clue what we're actually doing, but Jesus is being preached, lives are being changed, and my own daughter is getting baptized. You know, that's definitely that was a huge highlight, watching all these people come to Christ and seeing her make that public profession was amazing.
So how would you describe your calling?
I would describe my calling. That's a really good question. How would I describe my calling? I would say, going back to that moment I described in the reading the Martin Lloyd-Jones book, I very much would describe my calling from that point to this day as something that compels me, meaning that it wasn't like a great idea I had one day, though we may have those. It wasn't something that was formed through just a slow kind of reasonable process of like, oh, you know, I can kind of teach a little bit. Oh, I can lead a little bit over here. Maybe I should be a pastor. I think some people discern their call that way. Absolutely. But for me, it was from that moment, I just felt compelled. Like, I must do this. This settled conviction. I think it was Charles Spurgeon who said to his students back in the day, rule number one, settle your convictions. And I just, that was settled for me. Like, I've got to preach. And so therefore, I need to learn, I need to grow, I need to do this, I need to be faithful in season, out of season. So I would describe my calling as something that compels me. But I think also I would describe it as, I mean, ministry is, as anyone's going to tell you, it's got the high highs and the low lows. You know, there's the heartbreaking stuff of watching marriages fall apart and, you know, people just go through all kinds of suffering and, you know, people fall away from the faith. I mean, as you know, that stuff is heart-wrenching. At the same time, you get to see people, you know, saved radically. You get to see marriages healed. You get to see friendships formed. You get to see people view their jobs in different ways. And so I'd say it's both this, like, you know, kind of heavy and light burden. You know, I definitely feel the weight of ministry on a daily basis. So there's definitely a heaviness there. I know that when I get up to preach, I'm not at liberty just to, like, do some cool thing or just say whatever I want. Like, I'm a messenger, and I what's on the agenda is what's in the Bible. It's not my own thing. So I feel that very heavily, but it's also amazing. I think I remember reading John Stott's biography and he said, whenever I get up to preach, you know, I have a twinkle in my eye because I get to preach the word of God. And I read that and I think, man, it is amazing. Like this is so incredible what we get to do. So yeah, it's compelling, it's heavy, and it's joyful. Somehow, some way, all at the same time.
Well, Tim, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me, Sam.
You're listening to Premier Christian Radio. That was my interview with the pastor of Reality Church London, Tim Chaddick. I do hope you enjoyed that. If you'd like to hear more interviews with leading Christians, then you can visit our website, premierchristianradio.com/theprofile. This show is brought to you in association with the magazine that I help edit. It's Premier Christianity, and if you would like a free sample copy of the latest issue, you can visit our website, premierchristianity.com/free sample. Simply type your details in, and we will send you a free copy of the latest issue of the magazine. Well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today on the show, but if you want to hear more interviews with leading Christians, you can now access this show as a podcast. Just go to premierchristianradio.com/theprofile and you will be able to access past shows on your mobile phone. Just get the podcast, click subscribe, and you'll be away. Well, coming up next here on Premier Christian Radio is Premier Playback.
Weight loss solutions are not one size fits all. Hers makes it simpler to get started and stick with a weight loss plan backed by expert guided online care that puts your weight loss goals first. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you. With 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.